$1 billion a year.
Good morning. It is 9:01 a.m., and if you're joining us online today, this is the Senate Finance Committee. We're in room 532 in Alaska State Capitol. Today is Tuesday, March 3rd, 2015. Joining me at the table, Co-Chairman Kelly, welcome.
Hello.
Vice Chairman Michicki, welcome.
Good morning.
Senator Dunleavy, Senator Hoffman, and joining us shortly should be Senator Bishop and Senator Olson. Before the committee today, in order will be SB 6, the elimination of daylight saving time and time permitting. SB 30, marijuana regulation, will be rolled out and introduced. We do have a CS for consideration of the committee. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 629-LS0111/N before the committee as our working document.
Could I have an objection so that we can discuss the change?
Object.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Ms. Shine, if you could approach the microphone, identify yourself for the record, and then please let the people of Alaska as well as the Senate Finance Committee know the changes incorporated into the CS.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Erin Shine, and I am staff to Senator Anna McKinnon. The CS before you inserts two new sections. Starting on page 1, line 12, the first section adds a requirement that the governor petitions the U.S. Department of Transportation 21 days after the effective date of that section. The second section, section number 3, on page 2, line 11, provides the immediate effective date for section 2 for the petition. The effective date for Section 1, which is the elimination of daylight saving time, still remains January 1st, 2017.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Chair. Is it accurate to say that this, if this bill was passed, it starts a process? In other words, in and of itself, it doesn't change the time. The process is a trigger for the Department of Transportation to take a look at it. If they don't believe that it serves commerce well, they could deny the change. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that is correct. The petition that we would be requiring the governor of Alaska to submit doesn't trigger that there would be the process that they would go through the time zone change in Alaska. It would just start the process.
And again, they would have to determine if it serves commerce well. If it doesn't, they may not approve of the change.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Michelle, can you tell the committee what requirements the Department of Transportation uses to actually consider a time zone change?
Yes, I can, if you give me 1 second. I submitted a document to the committee that outlines the procedure for moving an area from one time zone to another that the U.S. Department of Transportation uses as their outline. The overarching substantive requirement would be deciding whether the change to a time zone is convenient for commerce. There are other documents that you could probably submit as well, but that is their final determination is commerce.
Thank you, Ms. Shine. Are there questions from committee members? I would like to acknowledge that Senator Bishop and Senator Olson have joined us. Welcome, gentlemen. Are there any further questions to the CS? Is there any further objections to adoption of the CS? If not, the CS is now before the committee and can be posted online for the general public. Thank you, Ms. Shine. With that, I'd like to proceed immediately to public testimony. If you could limit yourself to 3 minutes, we do have a fairly full bench that's wanting to testify on this bill. The first person to sign in and that would like to speak to the Senate this morning regarding the CS for Senate Bill Number 6, that is an act exempting the state from daylight saving time, is Mike Stedman, followed by Craig Dahl. If you could state your name and your affiliation for the record.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Mike Stedman. I'm a small business owner here in Juneau on Alaska Seaplanes, which provides scheduled service, charters, and tour flights throughout northern and southeast. I come before you guys to oppose the bill with the amendment that kind of changes things a little bit. I still do oppose it. I feel it's bad for commerce. We have several flights that with our on our flow plane side that fly late in the evenings, and by losing an hour of daylight, that's going to impact us substantially. On top of that, we do a lot of business with vendors on the East Coast, and this will put us 5 hours difference between Juneau and the East Coast, which would have a hardship upon us trying to acquire parts if we have an airplane that's down. Not only that, I think you know, from a personal standpoint, you know, I like to fish. My family likes to camp. We do a lot of stuff outside in the summertime, as most Alaskans do. And this will definitely have an impact upon, you know, the amount of time we get to spend in the outdoors and dragging a line through the water trying to catch a king or you know, just camping out. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Other questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Stedman, as you look at the issue from a business and an air taxi standpoint, have you heard or talked to some of the air taxis that are over on the other extreme of the proposed time zone change, that to see if they are going to be having the hardships that you've just spoke about?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I have spoke with a couple operators, and they have the same concerns. Probably not quite as extreme as we have here in Southeast, but there are concerns from some of the air taxis up north as well and out west.
So you're saying they're aligned with you?
Correct.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Olson, I'm in receipt of one from Northwest, actually, that says just the opposite. They said there's issues with fog in the morning. I'm not sure if that same person contacted you that was a float plane operator. Thank you. Are there further questions from Mr. Stedman? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Stedman, on could you give me a little bit tighter window of the evening flying? Would it be August, September time frame where it would really impact you?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it would actually start in July if this takes effect. Be mid-July is what we'd be dealing with from mid-August right now, and mid-August would be like mid-September.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
The next person before the committee is Craig Dahl, followed by Dan Corson. Carlson?
Corson.
Corson. Got it right the first time. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Craig Dahl, and I am the Executive Director for the Juneau Chamber of Commerce. And based on my intended comments, I probably have to change it slightly with the introduction of CS6, but let me state that I represent over 400 businesses here in Juneau, and based upon comments that we had from our members on the original bill, we took the time to directly survey our membership, and we had a very strong response. Over 25% of our members answered the survey, which was directed at the support or opposition to the repeal of daylight savings time. The results of that survey were 74% of those responding were against Senate Bill 6 and the repeal of daylight savings time. 20% were in favor, 6% had no opinion. The comments that really fell into two groups, one was certainly the loss of an hour of daylight, flight operations, marine tourism, anything that used up the daylight at the wrong end of the day. And I don't think everybody's had the same comment in the sense this is the loss of our recreation time and business time in Alaska. It's already a precious short summer, and we didn't feel that this was in anybody's best interest. The other part was the differential between having the time zones change in our adjacent market area, the Pacific Northwest, and then, of course, the East Coast, putting us an additional hour off of conducting business there. And while we respected some of the basis for the bill being proposed in the first place, medical and other studies being done, we just felt from a business standpoint that the repeal of daylight savings time was not in our best interest. I really probably can't speak completely for this committee substitute. However, it seems like a good compromise in terms of the preservation of the daylight hour that we're all talking about. You would still end up, it looks like, with a out-of-sync situation when the Pacific Northwest would change the daylight savings time, but that does nothing more than put us where we are right now. So it seems like a very acceptable compromise, but I would probably limit my comments based upon that that's not what I surveyed our membership for, but I'm pleased to see this substitute in place.
Mr. Dahl, if I might, are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, did you let your committee members know on the survey, did you talk at all about the other issues of why it was being proposed, or did you just ask the question like we did in the survey from our office that just do you oppose it? Or
yeah, actually what we did is we use an electronic survey system. We presented to our members a straightforward yes-no question and answer. However, we also provided them a link to your survey so that while we don't see those results, we felt that we gave the opportunity for the members to comment directly to you as well as to respond before we took a position.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Dan Corson, followed by Jim Pacey. Welcome.
Good morning. My name is Dan Corson. I'm the Director of Operations for Wings Airways. We do tour operations from downtown Juneau and float planes. I am against the Senate Bill 6 as to, you know, loss of business. I did sit down, and if this went into effect today for this summer, we would lose 15% of business due to the loss of the 1 hour. And that doesn't include on marginal weather days where it might be kind of dark and we just cancel just due to safety reasons. I also, as well as what Mike, reiterate what Mike Stedman had said, is that, you know, getting an hour more daylight in the morning doesn't really seem logical. You know, around here it would be 2 a.m. where there's nobody really up, as opposed to like 3 a.m. So instead of, and the opposite in the evening, you know, you can do more stuff when people are awake. So.
Thank you so much. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As the Director of Operations, obviously they're part of management there for the air taxi. Has there been a concern voiced by federal officials as to what this bill may have on, as I hate to say it, any type of enforcement action that may be against either pilots or the air taxi?
No, I don't. I have not heard anything from the FAA about any enforcement action. I'm not quite sure if I follow your question either.
Well, first of all, it's not FAA. It's flight standards. That's who I'm asking about.
Okay.
And as a director of operations, you obviously have a POI that's out there mm-hmm. that's helping yes. you and doing whatever. Has these federal agencies voiced an opinion on this bill as to whether they are going? It enables them or not?
No, they have not.
Thank you, Madam
said anything
Chairman.
To me.
Thank you for your testimony. We're going to call up Jim, and then I'm going to go off net and travel around the state a bit. There are people that have been waiting on the phone also.
Hello, my name is Jim Parise. I'm the Director of Fixed Income at the Alaska Permanent Fund, and I only speak for the fixed income team, which comprises three portfolio managers and an analyst. I am only speaking about the original bill because I haven't been able to look at the amendment enough to know how that would affect us. But we are opposed to the original bill. The reason being, when we try to recruit and retain fixed income investors, it's difficult on a compensation basis to do it versus other large asset managers. But one of the things that we do have a lot of success with recruiting and retaining is quality of life up here. One of the things we, you know, tell them is it's a great job. It's also a great quality of life. You come in around 5 a.m., which is when we have to be here for New York hours. It means you're going to go to bed a little bit earlier. You're not going to spend as much time with your family, but you're going to have that day. If we are 5 hours away from New York, personally, I'll be going to bed about 7 o'clock, and so will some of the others. I have teenage kids. My teammates also have children, and it's going to be less time to spend with their family. It makes it more difficult. It takes away one of the recruiting tools that we have when trying to bring people up here.
Thank you for taking time to come out today. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Jim. Through the chair, so if the CS goes through and we were to have two separate time zones, which is, I think, what it allows, your change would be, although you wouldn't change through the seasons, you would still only be 4 hours away.
If it's still only 4 hours, and it's only 4 hours, and then three, if that's my understanding, is that right, or is it always just four? I'm not sure of the, that's why I say I'm only really commenting on the original bill, because I haven't had a chance to look at the other and don't understand the implications of it yet.
Senator Michicki, it would stop flipping, so it would alternate between four and five under the current bill, and we would petition the federal government to advance. At least some people have suggested we should advance to Pacific time, which would make us three and four, depending. But Alaska would stop flipping.
That would be less troublesome. The only thing I would be somewhat still troublesome with that is the fact that there's still confusion between what our time zone would be with New York. And when we talk to New York, their first thought is not where Alaska is. They still have confusion even when we're 4 hours now all year round. And so to flip those times would be confusing, but that would be much more favorable than.
Senator Michicki.
Madam Chair, so it seems that if it were to go through and there are two separate time zones, you'd actually have an improvement from four to three for half of
the
year.
Would be an improvement for us, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Michicki. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
You were testifying in opposition or just entering comments? Was it personal or for your division?
Just entering comments.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate the feedback.
Thank you.
Going offline, Lynn Willis in Eagle River. Lynn, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Lynn Willis. I reside in Eagle River. I'm representing myself. I support this legislation. Again, the committee substitute is kind of turn things a little bit, but I'll talk about that in a minute. I have previously submitted testimony regarding this legislation. As in past years, to date, the proponents of keeping DSD have not presented a clear and compelling justification to require over 700,000 Alaskans to participate in observance of this archaic law twice a year. The intent of federal law authorizing DST is to save energy. And again, no testimony indicates a reduction of energy costs to Alaskans by observing daylight saving time in Alaska. Yet the state government has refused to end this practice, and we are about to participate in daylight saving once again. This Saturday, March 7th, according to the U.S. Naval Observatory, sunrise in South Central Alaska will occur at 7:42 a.m. The next day, on Sunday, March 8th, daylight saving time begins and sunrise will occur at 8:39 for an instant loss of almost an hour of morning light. The effect will certainly be seen and still felt by many on Monday morning as commuters, kids waiting for school buses, and many who work outdoors deal with the return of morning darkness. This weekend also begins the period of double and even triple daylight saving time until November 1st for those Alaskans who advance clocks 1 or 2 hours permanently in 1983. My motive to testify again on SB6 is that yesterday I heard about this committee substitute. I appreciate the concern of some who want to change time zones. However, I am very wary of this, perhaps well-intended effort, if it results in the co-opting of this latest repeal effort as the opponents of SB6 begin to call for a delay in ending the use of daylight saving time while the effort to realign time zone continues. Documents submitted in support of SB6 indicate that changing clocks to observe daylight saving time and are suffering the insult to our human circadian rhythm appears to be as unpopular with Alaskans as it ever has been. I urge you to enact SB6 in the use of daylight saving in Alaska during this legislative session. Please move this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Willis. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you for joining us today, Lynn, and I apologize we didn't have you when this bill was heard before. Next online, in Petersburg, Alaska, Tom Laurent. Tom, are you with us?
Yes, I'm with you. I just got the new amendment bill, so I'm speaking to the original bill. I am opposed, or Tom Laurent, I am opposed to Senate Bill 6 because 15 to 20 years ago when we originally went on Alaska Standard Time from Southeast Alaska and Southeast Alaska moved to Alaska Standard Time, we lost an hour of daylight in the evenings during the summers here. We are now being asked to give up a second hour of daylight in the evenings. If the bill goes through, I would like to see Alaska split back into 2 to 3 time zones. Other states are in more than one time zone, and it will allow the circadian rhythms of people to adjust to the correct daylight or sunset and daylight times. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Tom, for your testimony. One more online, and then I'll come back to the room for a bit. Paula Rake in Wrangell, Alaska. Paula, are you with us?
I'm here. Paula Rake.
Thank you.
I am opposed to this bill. I just now got the amendment, so I'm not familiar with that. But I'm opposed to eliminating daylight savings time for Alaska for a couple reasons. One is just the lifestyle issue. We're going to lose an hour of daylight in the evenings when we need it most. Once we get off work, an hour at 2 a.m. does me no good at all. And living in Alaska is basically all about lifestyle. The other thing it would do, it would move us away from the lower 48. Right now we're 4 hours from the East Coast. It'd put us 5 hours. We're 1 hour from Seattle. It would put us 2 hours. And who would know exactly when it was that the lower 48 switches if we're not switching also? We should be on Pacific time zone. If you were to look at a map, this would basically move us 2 hours away from the time zone that we should be in anyways. I think a better thing to do would be to petition the federal government to leave the entire country on daylight savings time all year round. I read your support for the bill and that for health reasons. If that were really true, you would think that every time we travel down to Seattle and back, we'd be risking everyone's lives just because of the 1 hour time zone difference. So, you know, we all travel out of the state. We all cross time zones, and I don't see the whole country falling apart because of that. I just would like to see the whole country stay on daylight savings time, and maybe you should submit a resolution to the Department of Transportation to do that. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we're going to return to Juneau for a few minutes. Stuart Cohan, followed by Tom Williams. Welcome, Stuart.
Hi, I'm Stuart Cohan. I have a business called Invisible World, and thanks for listening to me. I have had a business on South Franklin Street here in Juneau for 30 years, and I can tell you for sure that it will impact us in a number of ways. For one thing, that late afternoon, that evening, what we call the evening bite, when tourists are circulating after dinner and making purchases, is probably about 10% of our sales for the year. And if you take away the light, and people are, you know, at 7 o'clock when people finish dinner, they have a choice of getting off the boat, but it's dark and rainy out, a lot less of them are going to get off the boat, and that's going to affect a lot of businesses on South Franklin. The other thing is that we are changing our business model and going to a much more global model. We already source from South America and Asia, and now we are starting to import from those countries directly to Europe and to Canada, and as such, that requires a lot of, and to sell in those markets directly. As such, that requires a lot of integration with complicated software platforms, and we have to look for the expertise on those to the West Coast and to the East Coast. And so adding another 1 hour of time difference makes it harder if you need to call for support. Sure, you can do it in that 3 or 4 hours of the morning, but if something comes up in the afternoon, then you're kind of stuck. And in business, I know a lot of you are in business, you know that we have a lot of obstacles already with high shipping, high internet costs, high travel costs, and adding one more obstacle it's not going to put us out of business, but it's just kind of makes it a little bit harder. And I just don't see how anybody in Southeast Alaska benefits from this at all. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, Mr. Williams, Tom Williams.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Williams. I'm the financial officer at Ward Air. We're an on-demand air charter here in Juneau. I'm also the owner and operator with my wife of a vacation rental called Alaska Northern Sands. This legislation will adversely impact both of our business and our personal lives. consequently, we encourage you to table not only, well, I guess it's the committee substitute now, and don't pass it out. It seems to me that this initial legislation, there were two drivers. One were health and safety issues, but I think the real driver is the time zone issue. And as you can see by the committee substitute, that issue is coming forefront. The original bill would have had adverse impact on Southeast economy. We would have lost daylight for flights in the evening, which is a critical part of our business. As spoken before by Mike Stedman and others. But it also impacts our ability for the folks that come and stay with us at our vacation rental to enjoy as much of Alaska as possible in the evening hours. People, just because it gets light earlier, they're not going to get up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to enjoy the daylight. The committee substitute has the potential for creating multiple time zones. And I think that's a bad idea. And it's a bad idea because of the problems we encountered before we went to a consolidated time zone. You know, Alaska is a big state. We had a number of time zones prior to the consolidation. And we ended up with a compromise. Southeast took a hit by moving to the consolidated time zone. But I think it was a good compromise. And it allowed business to be conducted within the state on the same time zone. Back in the late 70s, when I originally came to Alaska, the state had multiple time zones, and it was difficult to do business effective business between Juneau, the state capital, and the rest of Alaska. So I think that was a big consideration back then. Compensate the southeast of Alaska by allowing a time zone change goes back to that problematic and actually creates a problem with us within the state and could be used for capital move folks to further create a problem, especially for Southeast. Alaska is a large state. We're a large family. Compromise is important. Let's keep it that way. This legislation, I think, has a number of collateral damage to it. So I don't think the committee substitute is a good approach, and I think the best approach is simply to withdraw it from consideration. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Mr. Williams. We're going to go back off net. Tom Mayer. Oh, I'm sorry. He's here for questions. Let me move. David Berg in Petersburg. David, are you with us?
I represent Viking Travel and AlaskaFerryVacations.com. I want to speak against the legislation. I feel that, as far as medical conditions go, I think we're going to have the same number of hours of daylight throughout the year, and blinds and blackout shades can work in the summertime for people that have trouble with darkness, just as they do by supplying additional light boxes in the wintertime. I think that visitors all over Alaska will be confused by the difference in time zones that we have, especially if we have a split. If we're on a different time zone at some portions of the year than other parts of the country. believe that there will be an additional cost to airlines and other visitor industries for adjusting their schedules to comply with different zones. And residents, I think, especially here in Southeast Alaska, obviously I've traveled around Alaska a bit, and I see the difference in times or in daylight from one point of Alaska to another. But that's something that that is attractive to Alaska, and I think that residents can be adversely impacted, especially here in Southeast Alaska, by the shifting of daylight to early in the morning hours rather than having us have opportunity to recreate and be with our families in the evening hours when we would have more daylight. I would recommend that you've put together a poll that indicates that there are a lot of people in Alaska for this, and I think that before we move forward with this type of change, that this should be a referendum to the people and put by a vote if you continue along this line. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, David. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing none, is there anyone else here in Juneau who hasn't signed up that would like to testify? Going back off net, Marina Lindsay in Juneau. Marina, are you there?
Hi, it's Marina Lindsay, and I'm calling to state my objection to Senate Bill 6. I live in Juneau, and eliminating daylight savings time will only further separate Alaska from the contiguous United States. I work for an office located in Maryland. I already get to work at 7 a.m. I have family back east, and I travel frequently. It's already very difficult to make airline connections from Alaska. Eliminating daylight savings time will just make it harder. It makes no sense to complicate doing business with or from Alaska and traveling to from Alaska because daylight savings time is a tiring transition for a few days. What about the adults and businesses that have to deal with the impacts of being farther behind the rest of the United States during the work week for the many months they were 5 hours behind the East Coast? Southeast Alaska has already compromised for the benefit of the state being on one time zone. We are in the wrong time zone for how far east we are. Please vote against SB 6. It's bad for business outside the state, bad for tourism in Southeast Alaska, and bad for those of us who have family and offices in the eastern United States. Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, the next person to testify before the Senate Finance Committee is Rick Currier. Rick, are you there?
Hello, this is Rick Currier.
Welcome. Your testimony, please.
Yes. I'm a teacher here in Juneau, and my wife is also a teacher. I teach high school. My wife teaches kindergarten. And both of us see a disruption in learning twice a year when clocks are reset. The going to and from daylight savings time results in grumpy students, grumpy teachers, and again, about a week or so, week to 10 days of adjustment to get used to the new time. That being said, I also am against Senate Bill 6, and as I expressed my views in an email to Senator Egan, if Juneau is in the wrong time zone under the current situation, and we would have more usable daylight, that is, afternoon, evening daylight, as many of the business leaders who testified today have said. If we were in daylight savings time or plus 8 universal coordinated time year round, this is especially important, I believe, in the winter time with, again, students going home from school, walking home from school, that sort of thing, and for the rest of us just for evening activities. So basically, in summary, let's avoid the twice a year, the biennial bother of having to reset all the clocks in the house and the disruption in our circadian rhythms, especially for those of us involved in the education industry. And let's put Southeast Alaska in a Pacific time or close to it. Thank you.
Are there questions from committee members? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Currier. Next off net is Dorothy S. Wilson from Juneau. Dorothy, welcome.
Hi, thanks. My name's Dorothy Wilson, and I live in Juneau. We travel a lot. The bottom line is I think the state should be on one time. I don't really care whether you're stealing daylight savings or get rid of it, but I don't think Southeast Alaska needs to be at a different time than the rest of the state. We had a business there for a long time. We did business throughout the state. I worked in another company before I worked in our business. And all of it, during that time, I had people in Anchorage and in Seattle, and I was always kind of juggling time frames to see when somebody was going to be at work. Once they went on daylight, everybody went on the same time frame, it was a lot easier. We retired in 2007, and we've traveled a lot since then. Pretty much we're traveling most of the year. I have family in Alabama, Florida, Virginia. Jim has family in Maine. We have friends and family in Illinois, Washington, Oregon, and Arizona. And we have traveled all those places, and sometimes we do it within a few months. And we fly and we RV, so we know the difference. But it doesn't take a long time to adjust. I actually find it easier to go to the East Coast, because when I go to the East Coast, everybody goes to bed early so I can catch up on my sleep. And if I get 6 or 8 hours sleep, it doesn't matter what part of the country I'm in. We live in Arizona, where they don't chase in the winter when the legislative season is going on, because one of the senators lives in our condo. And we don't have any problem with the fact that they don't adjust. And actually, in Arizona, it makes it nice, because our daughter's in Virginia, our son's in Alaska, they're both 2 hours apart. But I can adjust either way. Most of the time, I don't know what time it is. I just look at my telephone, and it tells me if we're in a different time zone. Senator Egan expressed some difficulty about flying, and I heard Mike Stedman and some of the other comments about flying. You know, with me, and I think with Jim, getting up an hour earlier, go to work an hour earlier. If you need to go to work earlier, if you go to work an hour earlier, you're still saving daylight. In fact, when I was single, I lived in Birmingham, and the company I worked for actually worked from 7 to 3:30 every summer. So everybody had more daylight time, and I didn't mind it. I got home, I had a day, I had more time to get ready. Anyway, I just basically want Alaska to stay on the same daylight savings time. We're en route to Alaska right now. If we'd known the hearing was going to be earlier, we could have come up a day or two earlier. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you for your testimony, Dorothy. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, the next off-net is Patty Mackey. Patty from Ketchikan, welcome.
Thank you, Senator and committee members. My name is Patty Mackey. I'm the president and CEO of the Ketchikan Visitors Bureau. There have been quite a few comments already made regarding some of our tourism-related businesses and the impact that the loss of daylight in the evening would have. So I will not focus my comments in that direction, although to say that the same is true for some of the maritime vessel operations that we have, particularly here in southern southeast Alaska. The issue that I wanted to bring to the committee's attention today has a lot more to do with tourism in general. And in Ketchikan, of course, the cruise industry is a huge part of our tourism business. We oftentimes, people think that when cruise ships come to Alaska, they come to Ketchikan first. But in fact, approximately half, if not more than 50% of the vessels come here on their way back to their home ports of Vancouver and Seattle. And because of our location, they are already, they have to depart at a certain time in order to get back to port, where they offload passengers in the morning and then load a whole new group of passengers and depart that same evening. We're already an hour different, and so because of Pacific Daylight and Alaska time. But if this bill were to go through, that would put us 2 hours behind Seattle. And that would actually create an additional hour that we would lose of port time. I did some very rough figuring, but I can comfortably say that taking those lost hours from all of those ships that are southbound when they come to Ketchikan would basically equal the loss of 30 days in port. And we know that spending in Ketchikan on tours, retail, could be as much as $8.5 or $9 million in the one season. That does not take into account municipal revenues that would be lost. We are regionally quite a bit different in the amount of daylight that we have in our part of the state, as much as 2 hours less than Anchorage and as much as 4 hours less than Fairbanks in those summer months. And so this does really have an impact on us in terms of commerce, loss of opportunity. When the ships are limited to their time in port, they will primarily schedule tours. Those tours will take place, and then passengers will need to board and leave town, and they lose the opportunity for a second activity to participate in and or retail opportunities as well. Those are my comments, and I sincerely appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us, Patty. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, the next person online is Posey Boggs. Posey, are you there?
Yes, hi, I am here. Thank you very much. My name is Posey Boggs, and thanks for taking public testimony. I would like to testify against SB 6, is that the one, on daylight savings, because there are 23 or so National Institute of Health centers of excellence, and they're all in Washington, D.C. They're all reflected up here in Alaska in our nonprofit work, whether it's for the allergies or arthritis or deaf community or diabetes. They're all reflected in our own nonprofits. And as a volunteer for literacy nonprofits, when we want to very inexpensively have online virtual meetings, invariably our colleagues are on the East Coast as volunteers at 8 and 9 and 10 at night just so we can have a meeting. And it puts a big crimp in my work for literacy because it's already impossible. It could take weeks to get a phone meeting with the researchers in literacy that I work with at Tufts University or Georgetown University, even at the ones in Yale. It's just so difficult already. And your volunteers are already giving a whole second shift of their life. And so I just would like this to go away. It would just help me so much. Thank you.
Thank you for testifying, Posey. Are there any questions from committee members? Next online is Mary DeSmit in Juneau, followed by Brett Carlson. Mary, are you there?
Hello.
Good morning.
Sorry, good morning. My name is Mary DeSmit, and I'm commenting on SB 6. I'm opposed. I live in Juneau, Alaska. I am a citizen of Alaska for over 40 years, so I've been through all the other changes with the time zone. I have been listening all morning to the testimony from Paula from Wrangell, Marina, the guy from Ward Air. I think this issue, because of our geography, we're such a big state, all of the impacts for the economy and commerce, the personal issues people have around losing an hour of valuable daylight for sports, quality of life, projects in the summer. Southeast has already taken such a hit by losing an hour. I think this is such a complicated issue, and I am reminded when I talk to local folks how many people didn't even really realize that this was this close to getting passed, and there just hasn't been enough testimony. I think the statistics for the polls have been not very accurate. What is the rush? Alaska's facing so many important issues this legislative session. I would like to see this bill not go through, have the discussion continue over time, and have there be a greater outreach, because this is hugely impacting. So that is my comment. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Mary. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, the next off net is Brett Carlson. Welcome, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you.
Hello, this is Brett Carlson in Colquitt, Alaska, and thank you, senators, committee members, for taking the time to listen, and absolutely appreciate Senator McKinnon's work on this issue for many years, and for taking the time to hear from a lot of Alaskans. And it is good to take the time, because just like each of you, Alaskans are hard going about their days, raising their families, and putting food on the table, paying the bills, and don't have, time to track on every bill down in Juneau, and particularly a bill like this that's almost perennially on the radar. You never quite know when to speak up or not on the issue. So I'm very confident. I know there's many, many sides to the issue, and that the senators are going to weigh them all and make a good decision on behalf of Alaskans. And just wanted to provide another point on the map in making that decision. It seems kind of absurd that in Colquitt, Alaska, or the Arctic, where we actually do have at least 4 months where it never gets dark, that daylight saving time would be an issue. But the reason it's an issue is that 4 months is centered around June 21st. So actually starting in mid-August, it does get dark. And one of the big economic contributors to our region are flight-seeing tours, where people fly from Fairbanks in three times a day, either in the morning, afternoon, or evening, north across the Arctic Circle, and then get back to Fairbanks. And it's a 4 or 5 hour experiences. And people are generally gonna choose one of those three time slots. So one third of our business takes place in the evening hours, and probably a disproportionate amount of that kind of takes place in the evening, because it's a nice time to fly. Even now, once it starts getting dark, we have to shift the departure times from 7 o'clock to 6 o'clock, starting in mid to late August, and that keeps us flying through the end of the traveler season, which extends to the end of September now in interior and Arctic. And with the time zone change, it would, essentially eliminate our ability to operate those tours, in that last quarter or third of the season, and definitely provide, have economic impacts for the region, whether it's people flying out of Denali across the Arctic Circle or out of Fairbanks. So just wanted to make the committee, and particularly our interior and Arctic Rest, Senator Rest, Senator Kelly, and Senator Bishop, of those impacts, and a lot of us in the industry don't talk to each other about, daylight saving time, and if it is an impact, and I never would have known that it would be an impact in Southeast Alaska without hearing it today. So definitely, as this bill goes forward, I think it's just good to continue to reach out to see what the economic impacts are, and recognize that hour of light in the evening means something for commerce, and I really would think anywhere in Alaska, even an extra daylight hour of shopping in South Central Alaska and Anchorage, and that too means something economically, and one of the reasons that daylight savings time has continued to exist in the United States for so long. And at the same time, recognize the health side of the issue, and which has been well articulated, and maybe an idea too, if the issue is switching back and forth twice a year, maybe we stick to daylight savings time year round. But thanks for listening, and thanks for letting me put another information point on the map, and I hope you continue to reach out to businesses and others to truly understand the economic impact before making the final decision. And thanks for all you do. It's deeply appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Carlson, as we look at, since you're involved with some of the air taxi operations up there north of the Arctic Circle in my district, obviously the grave concern has to do, and the paramount concern that we all have in the air transportation industry, is safety. There's been a comment by a couple air taxis that were represented here this morning that it may impact them from that standpoint. I was wondering, since you're in a completely different latitude as well as a completely different longitude, what does this do to the safety of your operations so that we can measure it from that standpoint? Do you have an opinion?
Through the chair to Senator Olson, appreciate that question. You know, we're also involved in an air taxi, and I realize if you're not, you know, involved in scheduled air service on a day-to-day basis, it may seem a little silly. You're giving up an hour at one end, you're getting an hour at the other end. But the reality is, the way people travel in Alaska, they tend to, you know, not fly early in the morning. They're flying later at night. And, you know, absolutely. You know, the reason we do move up our departure times and try to get back earlier later in the summer is to beat the darkness. And, you know, a lot of the rural airstrips in interior and rural Alaska, you don't have the sophisticated lighting and navigation systems you have elsewhere. A term that a lot of persons may not know unless you live in the Arctic is getting upside down in a lot of these communities. You wouldn't believe it until you experience it, whether it's on a cubic path or others. People are, you know, just their bodies adjust to the natural daylight, and they are a little upside down where midnight, believe it or not, isn't late at night. That's late afternoon or early evening. From a scheduled air service point of view, certainly that extra hour of darkness means of light versus darkness means a lot. Hopefully something the committee would consider too in looking at it. It's definitely a safety issue, and it's nice to have that hour at night rather than in the morning. Appreciate the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Thank you for joining us. Is there anyone else online wishing to testify on the CS for SB 6, Daylight Saving Time Repeal? Is there anyone else here in Juneau wishing to testify on the repeal of Daylight Saving Time? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. If I could direct the committee's attention to the fiscal note. We have a zero fiscal note in front of us. Tom, Mayor, thank you for joining us. Will there be a change in the fiscal note with the CS, or can you provide us that information?
This is Tom Mayer, for the record, Director of Division of General Services, Department of Administration. We do not see any change in the fiscal note at all.
Thank you so much, Mr. Baird. Are there questions from committee members? What's the will of the body? Senator Michicki.
Madam Chair, if the body agrees, I'm ready to move the CS for Senate Bill 6, Finance 29, version N from committee with attached fiscal notes and committee recommendations.
Is there any objection? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't object, but I wanted to state for the record that, you know, I understand the impacts of this particular piece of legislation to Southeast Alaska, and I've been a strong supporter of keeping the capital move here in Juneau. But when I look at the surveys, and I represent Western Alaska. In fact, when if you ever been into Dutch Harbor on Alaska, you are closer to Tokyo than you are to Washington, D.C. There are other parts of the state that are going to see great benefit as a result of this legislation. In fact, in the survey that was done by the chairman, every portion of the state of Alaska has supported the move in the I know there's been some question about the survey, but even in Southeast Alaska during the survey that was done by this committee, Southeast supported the time change, maybe not by much, but the rest of the state is overwhelmingly supportive of this particular move, many as high as 86% and as low as 75%. So with that, I will be supporting this particular piece of legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman, thank you for those comments. While you didn't object, I would like to put on the record so anyone listening at home knows how to find what you were referring to. When we originally introduced the bill at the start of session, our first hearing was about 20 days ago. And so from February 7th to February 27th, we had a poll available online. So it is very subjective in that it's only people that were highly interested in the topic that responded. But I would note that I specifically reached out to every chamber in the state, every school district in the state, and any opponents to daylight saving time to make sure that our reach was more balanced than just individuals. But it is only people who chose to respond versus a statistically valid poll. But as Senator Hoffman said, you can see from the survey results that different regions responded fairly equally. Whether that was for or against is yet to be determined. In a statistically valid poll, 6 years ago when I introduced a similar piece of legislation, the statistically valid poll showed that Alaskans supported daylight saving elimination by about 52%. So there are absolutely folks on both sides of this issue. But I'm happy to hear from Alaskans. It's their bill. It's not any individual's bill. This is a policy decision for Alaskans. Is there any objections to moving this bill from committee? Seeing and hearing none, the bill moves. We'll take a brief at ease. Good morning. If you're joining us online, the Senate Finance Committee is at a full complement. It is still Tuesday, March 3rd, and the next item before the committee is Senate Bill 30. It's marijuana regulation. Just a rollout so that the committee knows how we will proceed, as well as the general public. We're going to have a high-level overview of the initiative itself by Doug Gardner and Hillary Martin from Legislative Legal, followed by a bill introduction from Jordan Schilling with Senator Coghill's office and Chuck Kopp with Senator Michicki's office. And we hope to complete that within the next hour. We will have this bill back before the committee again on Thursday at 9 a.m. We do not plan to take public testimony until next week, so didn't want anyone worrying about how quickly it might move, but just an opportunity to really understand what's before us, the challenges and the opportunities for Alaska. With that, Doug, if you could identify yourself for the record, if Hillary could identify herself for the record, and then the PowerPoint is behind us.
Members of the committee, my name is Doug Gardner. I'm Director of Legal Services for the Alaska Legislature.
And I'm Hillary Martin with Legislative Legal Services.
Senator McKinnon and members of the committee, you asked that we do an overview of the initiative as a place to start. I understand that Senate Bill 30 is with you, but you wanted us to just sort of give the an overview, and I certainly know that Senator Michicki has a lot of experience with the bill and the issue, but here we go. I've got a few PowerPoint slides. I want to say at the beginning that the goal of the PowerPoint is not to try and in detail go through absolutely every aspect of the initiative. Some things are summarized. It's a lengthier initiative, and so the purpose is to try and get some working familiarity. Each of the slides generally tracks a section of the initiative. So here we go.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Senator Kelly.
This is the PowerPoint?
Yes.
And this is from Legal Services?
I put it together, yes.
Really? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Kelly.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner, please.
Sure. That was the title of the initiative, to tax and regulate the production, sale, and use of marijuana. The purpose and findings section, I wanted to go through each of these things carefully as you consider the context in which the initiative addresses marijuana. The initiative, as you can see from the first part, allows law enforcement to focus on violent crimes and property crimes. My understanding that is that that was a major focus of the initiative as it was being considered by the voters. The other purposes are to enhance individual freedom. And it makes a declaration that marijuana should be legal for persons 21 years of age or older to have access to and use as prescribed by the initiative. The other purpose and finding is that it's in the interest of the health and public safety for the production and sale of marijuana, now that it is legal, to be regulated. And the regulations in the purpose and findings section, as drafted by the initiative proponents, are that the individuals need to show proof of age before purchasing. There's a statement that the focus is for legitimate taxpaying business people, but not criminal actors, to conduct sales of marijuana. Marijuana is going to, per the initiative, would be sold by regulated businesses and would be labeled in such a way that consumers would be informed and protected about what they're purchasing. And initiative proponents made sure that there was no intent to diminish the Supreme Court's holding in Raven versus State regarding Article 1, Section 22 of the Alaska Constitution, that establishes a right to privacy in this context. Finally, it concludes its purpose and findings section by making clear that it does not, the initiative doesn't require an individual to violate federal laws, and it doesn't exempt any individual or entity from federal law. State law couldn't do that as a matter of law anyway, but it does make that clear. I'm going to go on to the next slide.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, that's a huge question. How does this mesh with federal law, federal enforcement?
Well, it really doesn't. To the extent that the federal government could, I mean, I don't think anybody anticipates the federal government will enforce marijuana issues and interfere with the operation of this law, but my sense is that if there could be federal exposure in certain areas on federal land, areas like that.
So for lack of a better way of asking it, the approach is in violation of federal law? The wording on the books.
The wording on the books.
Correct?
Correct. Marijuana is a controlled substance and regulated by the federal government and could expose people to penalties. I don't know every decision that has taken place as far as what the feds have said they're going to do or not going to do with respect to enforcement, but my sense is they have telegraphed that they're not going to, in the areas of banking and other areas, they're not going to pursue people criminally or otherwise for engaging in lawful marijuana use per state law.
Senator Dunley, on Thursday we're going to have a presentation from the Department of Law on the federal issues. Again, today is a try to understand the initiative. I totally understand your line of questioning. We are there and trying to anticipate your questions, but we will capture those additional ones. But you're welcome to continue. It's just that we do have it outlined in Thursday's presentation to cover the federal issue. Senator Machicki?
Madam Chair, just in response to Senator Dunleavy, I think it's at some point it's important that we lay out the situations where federal law, such as Coast Guard regulated vessels and air travel and that sort of thing, so that Alaskans understand those limitations as well where they collide with state law.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. I think Mr. Gardner referred to that federal land would still be illegal to use and possess on transportation to and from another state is illegal, so we'll cover all that, but I do want to try to get a high level of the overview with the support of the committee, but understand that there's questions, so please continue.
And thank you, Senator McKinnon. And on that, just to close on that federal piece, I do think that the Department of Law would definitely, because they interact with the federal government on enforcement issues, have the most insight to that. We can follow up with the committee if you need something from our office. So the initiative goes on to talk about personal use of marijuana, and the initiative makes very clear what the acts by persons 21 years of age or older are that are lawful, and it encompasses, as you might imagine, most of the facets of marijuana processing, using, displaying, purchasing, transporting, growing, or processing. The initiative makes clear that marijuana accessories, I would imagine that might be commonly referred to as sort of things sold at a head shop or other types of accessories that are related to growing, could be lawfully purchased by a person 21 years of age or older or sold. Noteworthy is that the quantity of 1 ounce or less of marijuana is what the initiative refers to with respect to possession. I'll talk more about that. The initiative describes that no more than 6 marijuana plants, 3 or fewer being mature, could be possessed by that person in their home. That would also an issue that the committee will likely need to consider is that the six plants can generate a fair amount of production, and so the initiative just simply describes that you can have those 6 marijuana plants, but that would also include the marijuana that can be produced by those plants on the premises where plants are grown. It also allows the transferring of 1 ounce or less of marijuana and up to 6 immature plants to a person 21 years of older without remuneration. It provides for the consumption of marijuana except in a public place, and it makes clear that a person that assists a person in doing those upper comments in the upper five bullets on this page, a person doing that wouldn't be in violation of the law. The next section of the initiative talks about restrictions on personal cultivation and provides for a penalty. The personal cultivation is subject to plants that are, you can personally cultivate as long as your plants are not in public view. The initiative describes public view to include some type of enhanced viewing. So if you had them in your backyard and had a fence around them, I think that's what the initiative would provide, would allow. Obviously, you could fly over someone's house and see them in the backyard, but that's not what is being, that's not the concern. So the level of keeping them from public view is provided for. It does require that the plants be secured from unauthorized access, and the plants can only be on the cultivator's property or with the consent of the person in lawful possession of the property. So if you rent a house, your landlord needs to let you have them in the backyard or in the house. And of course, if you own the property, that eliminates that issue. The initiative provides a penalty, I should say, I did not put it on the previous slide, of up to a $750 fine for violation of that provision, as long as you're doing the things within the ambit of the initiative. Public consumption is banned, violation of up to a $100 fine. I just distilled that down into the shortest statement possible. I think that's accurate. The initiative provides for false identification penalties. The initiative is obviously based on the idea that a person needs to be 21 or older in order to be able to possess and do the things that have been described. So the initiative provides a false identification penalty for people who are trying to be involved with marijuana but aren't of the requisite age. It provides that you can't offer a false ID to attempt to purchase marijuana products, gain access to establishment, and in that regard, I suppose marijuana is similar to alcohol in the sense that those types of provisions exist for false identification in Alaska law at present. Marijuana, as I said earlier in the purpose and finding section, marijuana accessories, moving to the next section, next slide, marijuana accessories are authorized for persons 21 years of age or older. I'm moving to the next slide. The initiative provides for lawful operation of marijuana-related facilities. It provides that a person 21 years of age or older with a valid registration can operate a marijuana store, retail store, can cultivate, can engage in a production, and also testing. This provision of the initiative also provides that a lease or allowing provides that someone can lease a property or allow the use of those types of activities on the property. And the initiative authorizes penalties for marijuana establishments that violate their registration and license, probably contemplating a legislative scheme or possibly a board type of penalty scheme for people who violate their licenses. Moving on to the last point on that slide, personal use provisions do not apply to marijuana establishments. It provides for a marijuana control board. The initiative sponsors, from the way I read the initiative, contemplated that the legislature might choose through a bill to create a marijuana control board in commerce and economic development, but the initiative itself contemplates that the ABC board would be the board that would do those types of things and regulate sale, etc., in the absence of such a decision by the legislature. I'm getting ahead of my slide. Okay, rulemaking. The initiative provides that not later than 9 months after the effective date of the initiative that the board would adopt regulations for the marijuana establishments that I previously described. Those would include procedures for licensing, application fees, et cetera, and qualification for registration, health and safety regulations, reasonable restrictions on advertising, and civil penalties for failure to comply with regulations. And so it's a fairly comprehensive, the initiative provides the authority for the board to, in essence, adopt a fairly comprehensive regulatory scheme for reasonable restrictions, as I tried to summarize on the slide, which would have been nice if I'd put up while I was talking about it.
Senator Hoffman.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And what is that date? No later than 9 months after the effective date. So what's the last date that needs to be?
Senator Hoffman, I'm most familiar with the criminal aspects of the bill. I'm going to ask Legislative Counsel Hillary Martin to answer your question. Thank you.
Through the Chair, Senator Hoffman, it's 9 months from the effective date of the Act. February 24th was the effective date of the initiative. 9 months is November 24th.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Please continue.
The initiative provides, again, for marijuana establishment registrations. These are applications and renewal applications. It provides the board will forward half of the registration fee to the local regulatory commission for the local government in which the establishments will operate. It also provides that local government, if a local government has enacted a numerical limit on establishments, that the board will ask the local government for input on location, et cetera. Local governments aren't required to do that, but if they do, the initiative sponsors drafted it in such a way that there would be state and local discussion on locations for marijuana establishments if the local governments chose to be involved. With respect to segueing into local control, that's the next section of the initiative. It provides that local governments may prohibit the operation of marijuana established by an ordinance or a voter initiative. Local governments can enact an ordinances not in conflict with the initiative relating to time, place, and manner restrictions on marijuana establishments. They can designate local regulatory authority to review applications, establish procedures for issuing or revoking a registration issued by a local government. They can establish annual schedule of fees. Local governments may issue permits directly to the marijuana establishments, which I think is noteworthy if the board does not act on an application within 90 days or if the board does not adopt regulations within the 9-month window that Senator Hoffman asked a question about a moment or two ago. The initiative is clear that it does not purport to require an employer to permit use, etc. So I suppose if you work at a place where you have a UA test or something, it may be that your conditions of employment aren't. The initiative doesn't purport to try and change those things. It does not attempt to alter DUI laws. As you know, it's a criminal offense the way that Title 28 is written right now to drive while you're under the influence of a controlled substance. Marijuana still is a controlled substance at present. It does not purport to allow the transfer of marijuana to a person under 21. And finally, it does not prohibit a person or entity who owns or controls private property from prohibiting or regulating marijuana. So if you own an apartment building, the landlord can tell the tenants that they can't use marijuana there. And in other settings related to private property ownership and control. The initiative does not purport to or address medical marijuana or limit medical marijuana in any way. There may be some practical results of that now that marijuana would be more, if now that marijuana is legal, and if the regulatory scheme comes into place that allow purchases, medical marijuana may be a less used statute in certain respects, just from that reality. The initiative provides, finally, at the conclusion, for definitions and some marijuana taxation issues. I did not create a slide for that. My main focus was to come in and address the things related to Senate Bill 30, but the marijuana tax would tax every cultivation facility as an excise rate of $50 per ounce. It would exempt, potentially allow for the exemption of certain parts of the marijuana plant from that tax based on weight. I would imagine that might be stem and other types of parts of the marijuana plant. And it allows the authority for the department to order that monthly statements be provided, basically be paying a tax on what you did the prior month at the end of the month. The marijuana cultivation facility would pay that tax by way of electronic notification, and it would provide for penalties if the taxes weren't paid. That, Senator McKinnon, is my best effort in an efficient amount of time to try and give what you had requested, which is a maybe 30,000-foot view of the initiative. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. For the committee, this is the chair's approach, and so I'm open to modifying that approach is why I'm sharing it with you. This particular bill, how we've received it from Judiciary, is one approach. And that approach works specifically, if you refer to this particular flyer, as far as it's not actual decriminalization, but it's trying to make the marijuana products legal. Hopefully I'm saying that accurately. But SB 30 is very specific, and it does not have regulation or regulatory aspects of the initiative in it. At least that's the intent, that this would be a bill addressing criminality in Alaska state statute as it stands. We also have another bill, SB 60, that's out there around the Marijuana Control Board. So when we start our discussions further and go into the overview, I'd like you to keep in mind that this bill, SB 30 before us, is specifically with the criminal portion of the bill. Does that make sense? Can I have some feedback from committee members?
Madam Chair, just to correct for the record, is it Senate Bill 60 that deals with regulatory or 62?
60 deals with the Marijuana Control Board, and 62 deals with the regulatory. Thank you, Senator Machicki. So with that said, Senator Dunleavy, you had questions about the federal concern, and I have many of those too. Specifically, as we go through the sectional, which is next before the committee, I would like to have any concerns specific to the criminal portion of the bill to my office as soon as possible so that we make sure the next discussions have all of your answers available to you to ask those questions. But if you have some now to have greater clarity on the initiative itself, please go forward. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for myself and the public, the difference between legalization and criminalization, the difference between something being illegal and decriminalized. I've heard many different definitions from lay folks, but how would you characterize, how would you describe the difference if marijuana was decriminalized as opposed to legalized?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I might ask for a little bit more clarification, but here's my first attempt. The initiative is very careful to, I think, create a allowable set of uses for marijuana, certain weights, certain amount of plants. The initiative does not, and this is just one person's view, I'm trying to give you a nonpartisan view of it, but if you're doing the things that are in the initiative, then really one way to look at this is to look at it as a non-applicability section. We use that in criminal law sometimes to say that if you're doing this set of things, then it's just not a crime. It's just not a criminal event. If you're And so the bill attempts to allow and not make criminal penalties applicable to certain conduct. The bill does not address, there's no statement in the bill that says that all marijuana possession of any kind, you know, it's not a sweeping, it doesn't allow all marijuana possession or all marijuana use. So it allows regulated and use that's consistent with personal use, other than the establishments that are selling into that market. And so I guess that's my way of trying to answer your question in terms of decriminalizing versus making some conduct allowed. I don't know if that was helpful.
Through the chair.
Senator Dunleavy, could I provide a little bit of information? When originally the Judiciary Committee took on this issue, it has direct regards to where you're going, or at least some of the information. They approached the bill on the onset with an affirmative defense in approach. And that affirmative defense was said that if you had marijuana, that you would never be, you wouldn't have a charge against you. And they took that as statute, as I understood it, from the medical marijuana has an affirmative defense, and that's why they started at that particular point. And then they went through the process of a defense approach. How would you defend yourself if you were a citizen of the state of Alaska against this, requiring the state to have the proof of burden versus the actual individual that might have it? The affirmative defense left the individual that might have an accusation placed against them for carrying an illegal substance. They had to prove that it wasn't illegal. And so then the defense approach was that the state had to prove the person was guilty. Doug, have I got it right so far?
The state would have to prove the person is guilty, yes.
And then the third approach that we have that's before us in Senate Bill 30, the CS, is an approach to remove marijuana as a controlled substance but still regulate it, so that's why it's so thick. So I just wanted to put that on the record, that there are these approaches that we've been morphing from, and you've just heard Mr. Gardner speak to a fourth possibility, and that is a non-applicability approach. Senator Dunleavy.
So I'll try and be brief. So I've heard many different versions or attempts at trying to explain this, but one that I've heard is that decriminalization basically would be, it's not against the law for you to smoke pot. Where legalization is setting up a whole industry, regulations, guidelines, et cetera, to regulate a business built around pot. What would your response be to that? And I'm simplifying what I've heard, but in other words, this is a legalization process as well as a decriminalization process, as opposed to if it was just decriminalization. You want to smoke pot, we're not going to bother you. But we're not going to get into the game of setting up a whole new business, whole new industry, complete with laws, regs, permits, et cetera, et cetera.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I'm still not sure I'm getting it, and I want to. Maybe go ahead.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, I think it's also possible to look at. I've heard one definition of decriminalization is just that you remove penalties for the activities. The initiative clearly seems to contemplate that certain things are not criminal or civil offenses. I think that your interpretation is a fair interpretation. The initiative is doing more than just simply saying certain activities related to marijuana are not illegal. It is also setting up a regulatory system.
To be sure, I'm not going to belabor it. I'm going to do some more research, but this question and the one I had previously regarding whether the federal government wants to enforce something, when it wants to enforce something, by the manner it wants to enforce something, is, I think, important for the state of Alaska because it touches upon a number of different issues, and that is, it's not you folks, trust me, but if we have a law, do we follow the law? And if we choose not to, who gets to decide that we don't follow the law? I'm just saying, I'm going to end it here, but if that's the case, if the federal government decides when they're going to enforce a law, and we can decide to create a whole new industry,
I think it opens up all kinds of possibilities for Alaska to ignore the EPA, ignore the Endangered Species Act, ignore. That's a whole other issue. And I don't want to take the committee's time on this, but there is a bit of a, how can you do this if it's against federal law? And I'm not judging the merit of the initiative, et cetera, but I'm trying to understand some underlying concept that supports what we're doing right now. And there appears to be some contradictions and things that, you know, at odds. So with that, I'll do my own homework and maybe share it with some folks later on.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I just have two things, a comment and a question. One is a comment, and it goes with what Senator Dunleavy is saying, is that marijuana is illegal in this state because it's against federal law. And one of the bullet points here on the purposes and finding, it says, does not require any individual or entity to violate federal law or exempt any individual or entity from federal law. That's kind of nonsense. It does encourage people to violate federal law. And that was one of the points of the initiative that was so disingenuous, and I think the people of Alaska were lied to on that point. And I think it needs to be clarified on the record that it is against federal law, and nothing we do here is going to change that it's against federal law. And I agree with Senator Dunleavy. I don't want to be beholden to the federal government. Well, we won't prosecute you on this. That's okay. That's like these goofy executive orders that have been, there was 22 of them that have been deemed to be illegal because the executive branch is kind of deciding to do things that are outside the confines of established statutes, federal statutes. And that's kind of what we're doing here. And in fact, we're giving the federal government more leeway to tamper in our lives up here. Now, so I'm not making a, I think that just needs to be on the record. It needs to be on the record over and over again, because there were things in that initiative that was paid for by this kind of megalomaniacal billionaire outside. There were a lot of things in that initiative process and in the literature that was distributed in that process that were not true, that were deliberately not true. And the people of Alaska need to know what's true and not true in this. And I think we start right here on day one in the purposes and findings section, and that is, here's the bad news. Possession and use of marijuana is against the law, no matter how you voted, no matter what the outcome of that vote. And I'll save my question for a different time.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On that point of my other two colleagues, I don't know how many people listened to the new Attorney General's testimony in front of the Senate Judiciary in Washington, D.C., but you can go back and research that, but she doesn't condone the use of marijuana and differs with the President of the United States on his opinion on that. And in the spirit of this, if that's the right word, I think we ought to ask for an opinion from the U.S. Attorney General and get a get-out-of-jail-free card if we go forward to try to work around this. I think there's trying to make a clear separation between personal use and commercial grow operation, and I'd like to see a clarification on that point, because if we go down that road, spend this money to do this, who's to say 2 years from now that a new Attorney General says, hey, guess what? We're going to enforce this, and now the state of Alaska is out all this money for implementing this program.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. We will have a presentation from the Department of Law. I've asked specifically what immunity legislators have in voting for a bill that we have full knowledge that is illegal at a federal level. And so there'll be a discussion on Alaska's Constitution and the will of the people that have expressed an opinion that is different than our federal government and an obligation to the people of Alaska. So we will have that discussion. Senator Machicki.
I think, unfortunately, there is a gray area here, what you're both saying. But, I mean, if you just think about Raven versus State, our state constitution privacy laws, which I know we're going to discuss, to the highest court, made it legal to have up to 4 ounces in your personal residence for personal use. So clearly there are applications where federal law defers to states' rights, and there are applications where they don't. So we're going to have that list of federal law that simply can't be broken as we move forward, and those where the state prevails, and I think that's an important line to draw. And as you said, Department of Law will help us with that line as well.
Mr. Gardner, closing comments.
Well, I think that just with respect to the federal piece, I mean, we're here to help. We don't have all of the answers. I appreciate the comment that it is a gray area. It's probably going to come up in the context of, imagine a hypothetical where there's a traffic stop, somebody's driving through, you know, if you were out here in Dredge Lake right now in that federal campground, and imagine if you were, you know, had a broken taillight and a traffic stop were made, and you're stopped by U.S. Forest Service Police Department, and you've got, you know, less than an ounce of marijuana. You were probably not in any jeopardy when you were driving through JPD's turf and down a city road or state highway. But when you went into the campground, you might have. I think that the committee is touching on a point of awareness that people should have, that may be a kind of fact pattern where this type of issue comes up. So just my last comments are, Senator McKinnon, if it would be helpful to you to get something from us on federal law, we can try and do that and do it in a time frame that works for the committee.
The federal discussion would be appreciated.
We can try and give you something concise on that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Martin.
Can we be excused?
Yes, please. What I'd like to do is ask Jordan Schilling with Senator Coghill's office and Chuck Kopp with Senator Michiki's office to join us at the microphones. With the support of the committee, I would just point out to the people of Alaska that we have 88 pages of document in front of us to try to implement the it's okay to have personal marijuana, as well as 160 sections. So I'm going to, if it's all right with the committee, ask for a couple of sections to go through, and then if they're all the same, we might advance a little faster after that. If you could introduce yourself for the record, gentlemen, welcome.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Michiki.
And you are here because you are our transition team from the Judiciary Committee to the Senate Finance Committee. Is that fair?
It's fair.
Please continue.
So when ballot measure 2 passed on November 4th, the legislature began looking at the different ways that we can implement this in our statute. The ballot measure's goal was clearly to legalize marijuana, but being only 7 or 8 pages, it didn't really do all of the things that were necessary to accomplish that. For example, it didn't amend any part of our criminal code. So that's the purpose of SB 30. And as you mentioned, Madam Chair, there are a few different approaches to doing this. Our initial approach, as you said, was the affirmative defense. And, you know, we use affirmative defenses in statute pretty frequently. It's something that we've used in medical marijuana statutes and the murder statutes. But despite that, there was some significant pushback because there remained the possibility that someone would have to defend themselves for doing something that the initiative said they could do. So as you mentioned earlier, we moved to the defense, similar pushback. And so now we're at our current approach, version F before the committee, which essentially removes marijuana from the controlled substance schedules entirely. This is what caused the bill to balloon from 9 pages to almost 100. And the reason being, there are a lot of conforming amendments in here that Chuck can go through, where we simply add the word marijuana. I would say about 130 of the sections in this bill are conforming.
Schilling, can we go through one or two just so that we can get a flow for what those sections look like that are conforming types of amendments, or Mr. Kopp?
Yes, Madam Chair. Section 1 of the bill deals with reckless operation of aircraft. A person may not operate an aircraft occupied by a crew member or passenger who is obviously under the influence of intoxicating liquor or a controlled substance, and this adds marijuana to that because it's pulled out from controlled substance. Section 2 deals with possession, control, or consumption by persons under 21 years of age and requires the court as a condition of probation to prohibit the use of inhalants, controlled substances, and alcohol as a condition of probation and adds marijuana. Section 3, duties and responsibilities of skiers, prohibits skiers from moving uphill on a tramway or using a ski slope or trail while under the influence of a controlled substance and adds marijuana, because marijuana was included before as a controlled substance. So on and on like that, Madam Chair.
Mr. Kopp, if I could ask you to pause. Senator Machicki?
Yes, Madam, through the Chair. Mr. Kopp, and that if the committee is interested, we can certainly go through each one, but I believe that brings us to Section 44. And then, of course, once we get through Section 54, we go back into conforming amendments. But do you see any value in continuing to go through each one of those, or should we move on to Section 44?
Brief at ease. Is it? I'd like to ask committee members, would you like to go through section by section to understand how each section was amended? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I look at this bill, it's obviously a pretty thick piece of paper here, and for especially those people out in my district, they have little understanding of what goes on here, and so I would, in order to explain it to them, I would like to go through it section by section to make sure that, one, we don't have people from my district that are unintentionally or for some reason wind up in jail and don't know why they have because of some misunderstanding that's gone on.
Senator Dunleavy.
Just through the chair, can you mention one last, can you just repeat one last time the thing on the skiers?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Dunleavy. This is amending current law dealing with duties and responsibilities of skiers that prohibits skiers from moving uphill on a tramway or using a ski slope or trail while impaired by alcohol or a controlled substance. Controlled substance used to include marijuana, but now we pull it out, so we have to add it in separately under its own name, adding marijuana to that also. So they can't be under the influence of marijuana.
Through the chair, so the snowboarders get a pass.
They'll be quite upset at this because now the drug of choice is specifically named in regulation.
They're not skiers.
Well, they fall under the definition of that. So,
Senator Olson, did you have a follow-up? I'm sorry.
Actually, on that, why are skiers pinpointed or in this category as opposed to other members, other recreational members of society?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that's a good question. This actually occurs in the title under amusement and sports, and specifically in that portion of amusement and sports that deals with outdoor activities. And skiing is a hazardous sport because of impacts, collisions, people under the influence, not skiing under control. So it's an attempt to provide a safe environment for downhill recreation sports.
Madam Chair, if I can continue, as you look at the issue out there, what about hunters and people that are out there doing essentially something that they have as a hobby?
Yes, and through the chair, Senator Olson, our misconduct and other weapons statutes do cover being under the influence in possession of a firearm.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Yeah, this is for Senator Olson, and actually it's more about safety on the moving tramway, the way it's written in here, than the actual act of skiing. So if you read that section 3, you'll see that it prohibits skiers with a wide definition from moving uphill on a tramway or using a ski slope or trail while being impaired. But
thank you, Madam Chairman.
Does the entire committee want to go through section by section? This is not changing any current law. It is taking the marijuana from the controlled substance list and putting it, beside alcohol. So there is nothing to change. There's no change to rural Alaska or to anywhere else in Alaska. It's purely changing, moving it from controlled substance and adding it as explicitly called out. So we can go through everyone, but it does not impact change. Mr. Kopp, help me out here.
Madam Chair, you explained it well. Because marijuana was always regulated as a controlled substance, this shows that we're still regulating it in the same way, but so we're naming it by what it's called, its own entity, marijuana, outside of the controlled substance schedule. So everywhere in the law where it said controlled substance before, we're just also naming marijuana, indicating we want the same safety standards and protection in place we had before.
Mr. Kopp, and no additional penalty. There is no additional law that is being suggested in the sections that we're talking about.
Not in the conforming amendments. That's right, Madam Chair.
Why don't we go through a couple more so that the committee can get a comfort level with that. Senator Olson.
Actually, Madam Chairman, what I would be more interested in doing something that's going to put people in jeopardy of having to serve jail time, that if you could just hit the highlights of those so that we can certainly look at the details and know where to go to if there is an issue that's out there. That's what I'm more interested in than every little skier exemption that you have out there.
Thank you. Sections 1 through 40 and 42 and 43 are conforming amendments as Mr. Kopp has presented. If I could direct the committee's attention to Section 44, where we start substantial conversations about implementation of the initiative.
And Madam Chair, if I could, 44 is where we begin to go back into the initiative language, which we just heard from Mr. Gardner. And I feel like the meat of the bill kind of starts at Section 50.
Madam Chair, I concur. Sections 45 all the way through 49 are initiative language, and Section 51 begins with local control.
Could you explain how you laid out the sectional if people were following by the sectional? We've noted a page number, I believe, so that committee members can follow along if they're using their sectional as a guide.
Yeah, absolutely. The first page of the sectional is the overview where we just, in big chunks, we show the members what's conforming and what's not. In the sectional itself, starting on page 2, we've got kind of three identifiers. We have the word conforming for anything where we're just simply adding the word marijuana next to alcohol and controlled substance. We've got another label that says initiative. You'll find that on, for example, Section 44. And then anything with big capital red letters that says substantive, that's where the members may be most interested in. And then, of course, we have the page number as well.
Senator Machicki.
Through the chair, gentlemen, I thought the value, we don't need a detailed discussion, but for those from experience in the Judiciary Committee, the public is interested in knowing that the initiative is covered in Senate Bill 30. So I don't think we need a lot of detail. I would just describe how it's captured in here and then move on to Section 51, I think.
Mr. Kopp.
Senator Machicki, through the chair. The initiative is covered in Section 44, beginning with personal use of marijuana, referring back to all the provisions under which personal use of marijuana is legal that we just heard from Ledge Legal on. Section 45 is initiative language dealing with the lawful operation of marijuana-related facilities, and this pertains to retail marijuana stores. Section 46 is also dealing with marijuana cultivation facilities, and Section 47 is relating to marijuana product manufacturing facilities. Section 48, this is a page here, is dealing with the lawful operation of marijuana testing facilities. So those are the four facilities that are regulated under the initiative. And then finally, Section 49 is the explicit provision that it is lawful for a person who owns or is able to lease their property to someone engaging in these activities, that they are not subject to seizure or forfeiture under Alaska laws because someone is lawfully engaging in one of the activities covered by the initiative.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. And so if we can begin on section 50 and page 29, we'll start an overview of the more substantial changes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 50 is the result of an amendment in the Senate Judiciary Committee. It simply directs the board to adopt regulations that prohibits a retail marijuana store from selling more than 5 grams of marijuana concentrate per day to a customer. Section 51 is where we kind of lay the foundation for the local option election law that we'll talk about later in Section 52. It says that an established village may prohibit the operation of marijuana cultivation facilities or manufacturing facilities, testing, or retail stores. And that would be in an attempt to kind of mirror the local option laws that we have in Title IV for alcohol. The initiative probably inadvertently left out some provisions that allow those in the unincorporated borough that don't have local government from prohibiting retail sale. Meanwhile, the initiative did give communities that are considered municipalities that ability, so there seems to just be we would like to line that up with alcohol if at all possible.
Senator Michicki.
And if I'm correct, still doesn't sidestep Raven. 4 ounces can still magically appear in the home of someone in a dry village in observation of Alaska's constitution. Is that correct? Yeah.
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, thank you. That is correct. This would give the community the option to ban the retail outlet, but not the personal possession limits and the growing limits found in the initiative.
Senator Bishop, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I wanted to go back to Section 50 for just a. This, you know, it talks about the five maximum of 5 grams a day to a customer. Is there a prohibit? So, it, like for alcohol, is there a prohibition? You can only buy one case a day or 2 cases a day.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, no. Not to my knowledge. I think you can buy an unlimited amount.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Dunleavy?
Through the chair. So we took marijuana out of the controlled substance list, so we added it back as a separate substance, like alcohol. Is there any place where we did not add marijuana in any of the cases where it was previously covered as a controlled substance?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, marijuana.
Are there any exceptions?
Yes. In Title 11, the criminal law, conduct that was previously criminal that is now expressly allowed in the initiative has been removed and not put back in.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'll continue with the new misconduct involving marijuana crime section. We'll call this Section 52. This now regulates conduct that is still prohibited, that is outside of the scope of the initiative. Misconduct involving marijuana first degree deals with a person who is not a registered marijuana establishment, so they have no license to sell, and they commit this crime of misconduct marijuana first degree, Class A misdemeanor, if they knowingly do any of the following without a license, and that's possess 25 or more marijuana plants, manufacture more than 6 marijuana plants, deliver or transport more than 1 ounce of usable marijuana or more than 6 marijuana plants, give any amount of marijuana to a person under 21 years of age, manufacture a marijuana concentrate using a volatile or explosive gas, deliver or transport 1 ounce or less of usable marijuana for remuneration, deliver or transport up to 6 immature plants for remuneration. The next section deals with a person who is a registered marijuana establishment and they are not in compliance with license requirements. If this person knowingly possesses 25 or more marijuana plants, that's against the law. Manufactures more than 6 marijuana plants, transports more than 1 ounce of usable marijuana or more than 6 marijuana plants, delivers any amount of marijuana to a person under 21 years of age, or manufactures a marijuana concentrate using a volatile or explosive gas. The next section deals with a person.
Mr. Hoppin, if you could pause at each section, please.
Sure.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The list you gave us is first degree Class A misdemeanor. The one that I'm concerned about is that gives any amount of marijuana to a person under 21. What is the current law, if you know it, on providing alcohol to someone under 21? What kind of a penalty is that?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it is a Class A misdemeanor.
It is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
A follow-up to that, through the chair. In the case of alcohol, you can have a child sitting 2 feet away from you, not involved in the drinking of alcohol at all in your home. In the dealing with the issue of marijuana, you're smoking, you're exhaling, there's a child 2 feet away from you. Was this particular issue that I just named thought through as you went through the bill? How do family members that are not otherwise of legal age but may be subject to the activity, how's that being dealt with, or how's that viewed?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I'm very sensitive to the whole discussion of secondhand smoke, and I totally agree with you that that's a problem. It's a real public health problem, but we haven't regulated that in the home yet anywhere in Alaska, and so it would be the same whether it was a tobacco cigarette or a marijuana cigarette. Secondhand smoke in the home, we've never had a public policy call on regulating that in the
room. To the chair, I respectfully disagree. This is not just it's not secondhand smoke; it's secondhand pot that the child might be inhaling. I'm just curious. Has it been dealt with at all? The secondhand inhaling, the secondhand ingesting, inhaling.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, not in this bill.
Okay, thank you.
If I may, Madam Chair, I'm looking
Jordan,
for...
Jordan, if you could identify yourself for the record, since it's two different voices, that would be helpful.
Yeah, thank you. Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. I'm looking for it now. I want to say that we did include marijuana in the endangerment of a child crime, but probably want to defer to our drafter on that one if she can locate it for us.
Senator Dunleavy.
Just one last follow-up. So I guess where the issue is, being somebody that's involved with children for the last 3 years in my profession, so you have somebody under the age of 18 that's attending school, and they're living in a house, and this is going on, and it's not something that they necessarily want to be involved in, but it's going on. And possibly as part of an extracurricular activity or some club, they may have to undergo a test. They're found to be positive. How's that dealt with if the child is not an active participant but is, as a victim, for lack of a better expression? How is that, has that discussion come up at all?
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. It's a good question. There are going to be instances that we will discover as we go through this process, and perhaps, you know, in subsequent sessions where we come back and we address specific sets of circumstances like that. But that hasn't been a focus at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Koff. Senator Dunleavy.
And just a comment. I appreciate that. It's a very complex new issue, and I certainly appreciate that, and you guys have put a lot of work into it. But thanks.
Senator Dunleavy, will you make that note? I wrote it down on mine, too. We are going to try to park in a lot the ideas for a regulatory bill or the board bill that we have, those other bills that are out there, and try to streamline this one so that we can meet the will of the people of Alaska in passing this particular portion of the bill. But if you have ideas that are not being addressed under the legal aspect of the personal use section, please let's make sure that we address the issue. Senator Machicki?
Yes, ma'am. Senator Dunleavy, that part of this issue is not new. Unfortunately, under Raven versus State, they would likely have Supreme Court protection for that sort of consumption in the home, since the privacy is held somewhat pure in that ruling. So I absolutely agree with you that I can't imagine subjecting a child to that kind of behavior, but that's existed as long as the Raven ruling passed, and it's a challenge.
Sure.
Senator Dunleavy.
Briefly, it may be something you can look at under the edible concept, the ingestion of a minor, because you might have, I'm learning so much about this, you may have edibles that look like gummy bears or cookies, and I just hope that doesn't happen. But anyway, you might have that, and a child may pick it up. Could this fall into the same issue in which you have a child within the cloud perimeter
of what's going on in the household. I open this up by saying I could theoretically have a child 3 feet away from me if I'm drinking a beer, but that doesn't mean the child is participating in that activity at all. They're not ingesting the alcohol. They're not. There's no effect from what I'm doing with them, but this is a whole different ballgame. And I understand the Raven issue, but anyway, I think I made my point. We may want to look at that in part of, as part of the subsection in the edible issue or something along those lines.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. That would be taken up in the regulatory bill. One of the reasons why we provided this particular document is so that you could write it down if we had something that we were missing that we don't think is currently under the regulatory, that you could, for lack of a better phrase, put it in a parking lot so that we don't forget the item. If I could take a brief at ease. We're back in session. For those listening at home, I was trying to determine if people had conflicts or whether we could continue with this overview for about 25 more minutes. Mr. Kopp, Mr. Jordan, please, if you could identify yourself when you start to speak so that we can help the clerks if, when they go back and make sure we have meeting minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Peter Michicki. I was just chastised by my coworker here, Mr. Schilling, for not sharing with the committee that reckless endangerment of a minor would, in fact, cover a situation where a minor child is put at risk of harm. And I think as this the science gets rolled out and we see that secondhand marijuana smoke is harmful, that could be covered under current criminal law regulation. If I may continue, Madam Chair, with Section 52, misconduct involving marijuana, first degree, the third section of that, 1738-200 offense is dealing with registered marijuana establishments who do acts with criminal negligence, and those acts occur allowing a person to deliver marijuana to a person under 21 who is not a medical marijuana patient 18 years of age or older. They allow a person 21 years of age to, or under 21, to enter and remain on the licensed premises who is not a medical marijuana patient 18 years of age or older. Allow a person under 21 to use marijuana within the licensed premises, allows a person under 21 to deliver marijuana, or while working on the licensed premises, delivers marijuana to a person under 21 who is not a medical marijuana patient, 18 years of age or older. This is just as a discussion point, Madam Chair, this has been brought to our attention that this was an attempt to help minors with medical marijuana cards get their marijuana, but not allow for someone under 18 or a juvenile to enter a marijuana establishment. But inadvertently, we created a situation where there was no culpability for an establishment allowing a person to do marijuana-related activities for a person under 18 years of age. So we anticipate those qualifiers coming out to just keep it clear that if you're under 21, you're not allowed on licensed premises, and it would provide that possibly an exception could be that 18, 19, and 20-year-olds would have to be accompanied by a guardian if they had a medical marijuana. But so we're working on that one. Misconduct involving marijuana in the second degree is a Class B misdemeanor. And this speaks to a person who is at least 21 years of age, who is not a registered marijuana establishment, and knowingly possesses 7 to 24 marijuana plants, or possesses, purchases, displays, delivers, or transports more than 1 ounce of usable marijuana in a public place, or possesses or delivers more than 6 marijuana plants. It also relates to a person who is a registered marijuana establishment that is not in compliance with the registration requirements and knowingly possesses 7 to 24 marijuana plants, delivers or sells any amount of marijuana, or a person who is not a registered marijuana establishment and knowingly sells any amount of marijuana. I'll now turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Schilling, for a continuation.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Now we are discussing misconduct involving marijuana in the third degree. This is a violation for manufacturing or growing marijuana in a location that's visible to the public or on property that's not yours unless you have consent of the property owner. It is a violation if you are under 21 and attempt to purchase marijuana with false identification or otherwise misrepresent your age. It's a violation if you are under 18 and possess, use, or display any amount of marijuana. And this section does not apply to a person assisting law enforcement. So, for example, a minor at the direction of a peace officer going in to make an undercover buy, something of that sort, to determine if the licensee is doing things properly. Then we move on to misconduct involving marijuana in the fourth degree. Again, this is a violation. If you are over 21 and use any amount of marijuana in a public place, this has been a discussion point over the last few meetings. What does public mean? And for the purpose of this bill now, as written, the definition can be found in Title 11. It's 1181-900, I believe subsection 53. But basically the definition says a public place is any place where a substantial group of persons has access to, including but not limited to, and it lists off a whole bunch of things, highways, alleyways, sidewalks, parks. So it's fairly comprehensive. It appears to preclude the possibility of there being private marijuana clubs or, you know, outdoor events. It's pretty comprehensive, and it's the definition that they use in the stalking statutes, for example, the crime of stalking. So.
Senator Dunleavy.
Chair, and you can just direct me where it's in here, but if you're in a condo or a very tightly packed zero lot line situation where you've got the window open and it's going into the neighbor's window, is there something here addresses that? A nuisance factor?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, there is nothing in this bill. I know that the Fairbanks North Star Borough recently had an ordinance that attempts to define nuisance and is looking at that exact matter.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. I did have a request. Could you explain what the violations are, the penalties? If you violate this, what the penalties are?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. For misconduct involving marijuana in the third degree, that's the first violation, it is a fine of $300, not up to, just $300. And then misconduct involving marijuana in the fourth degree is a fine of $100.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy.
To the chair, along those lines, so tomorrow with the Department of, or when we do the Department of Law on this, will they explain to us if those fines and those criminal penalties are, how that relates to the federal law? So, I mean, you get dinged once, and if the feds decide to enforce this law, you get nailed twice?
Senator Dunleavy, I think that answer is you get nailed twice. But, well, Department of Law is in the room, and hopefully we'll note that for Thursday. Please continue.
Madam Chair, on my spot here, we'll continue with proof of registration to be exhibited and carried on demand. This is pertaining to marijuana establishment registrants, and this requires a licensee to have a copy of their marijuana license at all times when transporting more than 1 ounce of marijuana and to present the license on demand by a peace officer. This is a correctable citation. It's a $100 fine if you show later that you have a license in court or to the citing officer. The fine can be dismissed. Bail forfeiture for certain offenses requires the court to make a bail schedule allowing defendants to pay the fine for violations without a court appearance for misconduct involving marijuana third degree and fourth degree, which are violations. Restriction on prosecution for certain persons in connection with a significant adverse marijuana reaction. This was a law the legislature passed actually last year, now being amended into this, which just provides that you may not be prosecuted for certain marijuana misconduct crimes if you in good faith are seeking law enforcement or medical assistance to someone you believe is experiencing a significant adverse marijuana reaction, and you remain at the scene and cooperate with law enforcement and EMS personnel, and the evidence discovered would not have been discovered if you hadn't stayed and cooperated. The affirmative defense to the prosecution under misconduct involving marijuana, first degree through fourth degree, involving the medical use of marijuana, just lays out what those defenses are if you are properly registered as a caregiver, as an alternate caregiver, you have a license in your possession, and you are otherwise in compliance with the law, then whatever you're possessing and caught with, if you are licensed under our medical marijuana statutes in 1737, that is a defense. Finally, 1738-280 deals with court records of violations by minors. The version of the bill before the committee says a confidential. The desire of the Judiciary Committee and many of the people who spoke is that the court records of minors who commit violations, so not criminal violations, but citable violations, would not follow them for the rest of their life and preclude them from being eligible for military service or other jobs that they may get at that young age. So this language was written in a way that that record would become confidential once a case is closed and set aside after it's been disposed. In fact, one of the issues is we can't quite make it confidential because confidential means the record is entirely not available for public review. But what has happened is our Supreme Court has very recently allowed us to bifurcate the issue of a public record from what's publicly available on a website to the hard copy in the courthouse. And for the first time, they have told us that we can make a policy call to remove a public website record as long as we're not also removing the hard copy in the courthouse. And so we're looking at this with respect to minors under 21 for violations only, that once the case is closed, that would become not available to the public website anymore. Still would be a hard copy at the courthouse, but it would mitigate against the prohibition of employment in the future for young people. I'll now turn it over to Ed Jordan.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Next, we move on to some more detail on how the local option works. 1738-290 says, an established village shall prohibit the operation of marijuana establishments if a majority of the voters in that election approve the ban. And then it says that the ballot question should be worded pretty close to how it is here in statute.
Madam Chair.
We're on page 35 now. So that if people are following at home?
That's correct. Page 35, line 10.
Thank you. And Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And under the definition of local government, does the boroughs have the same rights to opt out? And what is the order if a local government decides that they want to stay in? Who has the controlling factor, the local community or the borough, on whether or not they opt in or opt out?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the initiative itself gave municipalities the ability to opt out. They would just do that, you know, through their city council or assembly. They would pass an ordinance. However, it's the area, these local option provisions are to address those parts of Alaska that don't have a city council or a form of local government. So this would be the established village making this call. And we do have a definition for established village on the very bottom of page 37. It's really an area that is outside of the purview of a form of government that has 25 or more permanent residents.
Senator John Levy?
Through the chair, this may be moot since the federal government doesn't look like they're going to enforce their laws. For those areas of the state that are in trust status, like Metlakatla, Winnett Island, is there anything that needs to be viewed differently in terms of the application of the law being a reservation?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I don't know that one. I can find out. It's Metlakatla, you said?
Yeah, Winnett Island.
Senator Hoffman, did you have a follow-up?
No, thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I have a follow-up to Senator Hoffman's bill here. We understand the local option issue that the village and the established village. What about, can a borough, because I represent two boroughs, can they go ahead and put some type of law and order for, and that would prevail over the borough that's the boundaries thereof?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, a borough can choose to opt out of having a retail store. Yeah.
And would that take precedence over the local village?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I would think so, but I'm not positive. I can find that out for you.
If you would, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Senator Dunleavy, followed by Mr. Kopp.
Briefly through the chair. If you can find out if it's a city status that determines that, for example, in the Mat-Su, there's three cities, and how that would play into it. And I think in some of the other areas of the state, there may be some communities that aren't necessarily first-class cities. And
Mr. Kopp.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, to your question, that's a good one. The bill explicitly gives authority to established villages to have their local option. If they get 35% or more of the residents to sign a petition calling for it, they can vote for it, and it even gives them the ballot language, how to ask the question, and then if they don't like it, how to repeal it. I think you have to wait a year, and then you can repeal it. But it's very explicit that established villages have that authority on page 36, 1738, 320, procedure for local options elections. It is a good legal question if the borough had a different option, but I just wanted to make it very clear that established villages seem to very explicitly have the authority to make their own judgment call on that.
Senator Hoffman.
On that point, Madam Chair, does that definition vary, whether that community is in the unorganized area of the state or the organized area of the state? Is there a differentiation?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I think the definition of established village applies statewide.
Please continue.
The next section is the process for removing a local option. Just one thing of note, if a registered village were to remove their local option, they shall give priority to an applicant who was formally licensed, so licensed prior to the prohibition.
Senator Machicki.
Gentlemen, it may be worth parking that question about whether or not a municipality under the leadership or under that's in an organized borough may have that option. I hear what you're saying about the village. I'm wondering about municipalities, so it may be worth clarifying that sort of formally with Department of Law or for a future meeting.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
The next section describes the procedure for local option elections. As Mr. Kopp said, if you can get a petition with 35% or more of the registered voters, that incurs an election, a special election. The Lieutenant Governor conducts the election. And a local option may not be conducted during the first 24 months after the local option was adopted, or more than once in a 36-month period. And the next section talks about the perimeter where this local option would apply. It's a 5-mile radius of the post office, but if there is no post office, the 5-mile radius of another site selected by the local governing body or by the board, either the ABC board as it stands now or the Marijuana Control Board, if the established village does not have a local governing body. And the next section simply describes how notice of the election results are transmitted.
With that, are we ready to begin Section 53? I think that we're probably going to need to pause. It's almost 11:25. Members have extended their schedules already by 25 minutes. If we could ask you to return on Thursday to lead us off, we'll schedule with the Department of Law to try to answer the questions that were brought forward, as well as give us a perspective on implementing some of the things that this legislation proposes to do. Is there final comments from committee members? Senator Machicki.
I wanted to correct something for the record. When I talked about the duties and responsibilities of the skier earlier, it does include the use of the ski slope or trail. And primarily what the earlier conforming language is just pointing toward impairment. It used to just say alcohol. Now it says alcohol and marijuana. So I just wanted to clarify that for the record, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Any other comments from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, please be advised that Wednesday, March 4th, the Senate Finance Committee will meet here in this room, 5:32 at 9 a.m. We'll have before the body SB 27. It's our appropriation bills, the operating budget for the Department of Administration, Revenue, and the Alaska Courts. If there's nothing further to come before the committee, seeing none, it is 11:25 and the committee's adjourned.